This is a Saturday seminar with Asha Praver of Relationships and Chakras.
All right. There is a complexity with this class, and I'm going to do a disclaimer right now, okay? You are not going to learn as much about the chakras as you want to. I promise you that. You are not going to walk out with as much practical technique and information as you want. It is simply impossible in the time given for us to really cover the subject. This is always a little bit of a tricky business because it's such an interesting class, but it's just impossible to do it all. So this will be like, you'll walk out with a lot that will help you, but not as much as you want. That we do give a 4-week class series on the chakras that Robert and Sharon teach. There are a number of tapes. Their classes on recording, classes I've given on the chakras are on recording. If you don't see it on the shelf, ask somebody if you want a class from me or if you want a class from them, and they can give you the tapes, sell you the tapes very inexpensively. And in my class series on the chakras, I still don't tell you as much as you want, but I will tell you a whole lot more than you're going to hear from me today. There's also a handbook, a little booklet put together by a woman named Savitri, which is in the teaching center, the booklet, and it's a handbook on the chakras. There's a lot more information in there. The Raja Yoga big, thick book has information on the chakras. All of that is to get me off the hook. Now, I'm not going to shirk the subject at all. It's just that it's too complex to cover in this amount of time. Also, because even though most of the people who show up for this class tend to be leaning on the chakra side, my approach to it is going to be through the subject of relationships, because that helps also to narrow the field a little bit. But in as much as the chakras is the fundamental basis of what we're talking about, I will also give you as clear as I can, I'll share with you as clearly as I can, some fundamentals that you can work with. Because it's really wonderful that you're all interested, because there's a real secret here that is really a great help to you. Many of you have been in my classes before. I tend to talk a lot, and I pour out a lot of information. I'll stop periodically to let you ask questions. If you have a burning question and you want to ask it while I'm still talking, signal. And when I have to stop and take a breath, then I'll take your question. I don't mind diverting the energy according to your questions, because there's so many different things I could say. If you want to define it by your questions, it'll all work out in the end. It's pretty much of a free flow because we can't cover everything anyway. I had one more other thought. It's gone. So when it comes back, we'll talk about it. Okay. I'm going to start with some very basic definitions and understanding of what the chakras are. Because it's become one of those words. The word chakra is not an English word, of course. Although in the great egalitarian spirit of English, we just kind of adopt words. I'm not a linguist. Kriyananda, who is the founder of Ananda, speaks 8 languages, and so he often talks about language as an entity. I just pick it up on the side from listening to him. But English is very open-hearted about accepting other languages, and that's why we have many more words in our language, like tens of thousands more words in English than there are in other languages. When we went to visit Italy the first time, and I couldn't speak any Italian, I would just listen to it afterwards. I said to Kriyananda, we were with him, I said, they don't seem to have very many words. I keep hearing the same words repeated. And he said, by comparison, it's true. It's just a smaller language. France actually has a board of governors who will determine on an annual basis what words will be allowed into the French language. And they won't allow corruptions like you do. You go now to foreign countries, and a tremendous number of words, like ballpoint pen, and of course computer words, are just imported into their language. So they'll be talking along, speaking French or Italian or German, not French so much, but Italian or German or something. And then what sounds to us like English words will just pop in. And so it is in America. Now we are absorbing a lot of words from the East. We absorb words from everywhere, like jungle and pajama, pizza, things we don't even think about. We think of those as English. But we're absorbing these words from another culture, and they're not English. So we have this word chakra. And because there is no English word for it, because the original creators of English were not interested in the chakras, so they did never talked about them. Now that English-speaking people are interested, we have to pull in words from elsewhere. But But what happens when we pull in words like this, and guru is the most impressively corrupted word now, we think we know what they mean, but we don't really know what we mean. Sometimes, just by the way, funny things happen. I won't go any farther in this diversion, but to dine al fresco in America means to eat outside. Al fresco is sort of a joke for being in prison in the original language, I think Italy, where it came from. And it was sort of like al fresco meant that you were incarcerated. And now it's come to us, this is how Swami described it, that al fresco means to dine elegantly outside. And they're very amused when they sort of hear what happened. But in the fresh air, of course. But the word chakra actually means wheel. And it's a spinning, it means wheel because it's something that spins, right? Now, the reason that that word was adopted is because we're really talking about energy. And energy is not a static, fixed thing. Energy is something that's in motion. And so when you can actually see the force fields, you see it as a movement of energy. And so the word chakra is used to describe these fields of energy that are in motion. And they actually spin in a circular manner, and so that there is a wheel-like effect. So it isn't in itself. It has no more profound meaning than that. It just has come to represent these particular fields of energy which move in a wheel. Now let me just sort of try to start more at the beginning with this. All of us obviously are sitting here in physical bodies, and we're looking out at this experience from inside a particular body. And our life experience is pretty much defined by the body that we live in. We're here, and if I walked out and went someplace else, that's where my body would be, and therefore that's where my consciousness would be. And you all come from many different places, many different countries, different homes. You move your body around, and that's your vantage point, right? And because that's always our vantage point, we get the impression that that's what we are. And if you really think about your life, it's a fascinating meditation just to reflect how profoundly defined you are because of the body you live in. You have an age, you have a gender, you have a nationality, you have a profession, you have a family, and all of those things become isolated realities because with one body, that's the way it is for you. Some people identify so strongly with that one body that anybody outside the family unit, for example, is just total strangers. Or the country that they were born in is total strangers. Or people who don't follow my profession or belong to my religion. And so they take the body identity. Some people are entirely singular. They'll just take and grab for themselves. They'll murder other people. They'll steal. Because this is me, and that's you, and everything is separate like this. Now, this is fundamentally not true. And as we begin to wake up and expand our awareness, without ever deciding that I am not my body necessarily, we start expanding that which we identify and embrace as our own as bigger than our body. Right now, in this particular culture, there's a tremendous movement, you know, away from ethnic stereotyping. I mean, I look around at this room and I can see that even though everybody who opened their mouth spoke English in an extremely American way, except Sherit, who had a little bit of her Israeli accent still there, but with all due respect, Malou, who have a name that's not American and a face that clearly shows you your, at least your relatives were born somewhere else, but if I just heard your voice, you're as American as anybody could be, because there is just this embracing that's going on that even extends beyond people who are living here to other countries, this realization that somehow just because our bodies are American or Chinese or Taiwanese or Vietnamese or whatever it is, that still the body doesn't define us. There's this shared humanity. And there's this great movement away from dogmatic religion. Everything that separates us we're trying to break down. Men and women used to be very polarized in their relationships to each other. But now women don't like being boxed away. And men really are responding to it they're in favor of it, but it's a little more confusing, and that's the relationship side of our question. The great shift in women's consciousness has created a dissonance that has not yet been resolved in our culture, and that's one of the fundamental problems we're having in relationships right now, is not that the women's consciousness is wrong, It's just that it has moved, and there hasn't been, nobody quite knows what to do with what's happened. We've wrecked the system without yet entirely creating another one. And it's too late. The toothpaste is out of the tube. We can't really squeeze it back in. I mean, just even looking at the way the women are dressed here today, and there's, I've read, and it's very interesting, that the more restricting women's clothing is, the more confined their roles are. And as the roles of women shift, the fashion shift. Because when you're in a big hoop skirt and a corset where you can't breathe, and a dress that, did you know, that's 4 feet wide and so on like that, it's, you can't sort of run and ride and work in the same way. And the more that women want to move into times when we work and behave as equals, the more we dress in ways that are free. It's very interesting to watch in India now, because whereas the women always used to wear saris, which are surprisingly more versatile than you would think once you trust that it won't fall off. Or like Indira Gandhi, put a pin in the critical place, right? But nonetheless, now you see even elegant dressed up Indian women tend to wear the alternative, which is a long tunic and pants. And it's very, only the more old-fashioned women still wear saris. But all the modern women are wearing the tunic and the pants. Still elegantly beautiful. But you can see just much more. You can move around and do a lot more. Because even in that culture, the whole thing is shifting. And you see the freedom in the way the women are dressed. Well, all of this is to say that where I was going with this when I started was talking about who are we? Who am I? Who am I really? What is my reality? And we have this apparent definition by our bodies, and yet we have this experience that there's so much more going on. Not the least of which is this body changes all the time. I was 55 earlier this week, which is sort of a middle age, and I had an occasion to visit a woman who happens to have my same birthday, but she's 31 years older. And right at the age I am, I'm just at the point where I'm youthful, but I'm no longer young. It's a very fine distinction. And I was given a great birthday gift by visiting this woman. She's a violinist, just a very fine lady. And she just turned, I guess, whatever, 86. Because she's 36 years, 86? Yes, 36 years older than me. And she's so beautiful. But she's not beautiful like a young girl. She's just beautiful. She has perfectly white hair. She's kind of all bent up. She doesn't have that wonderful figure anymore. You know, it's sort of gotten a little dumpy in there. Her face is wrinkled. She has all these things. And she's just lovely. And I looked at her and I thought, what a stupid thing to be concerned about. Which I have been more concerned than I like to admit. By just the sheer confusion of looking in the mirror and just watching it disintegrate right before me. And it's so confusing to watch it disintegrate because you're not different inside. And the more your body shifts, which is a hard thing to realize when you're young, because even though we've had a bazillion bodies, when we get that young one, we just think, here, I've got it again. And we just think we're going to keep it. It slips away very gradually. And age is less kind to women usually than to men. And it just that whole thing happens. But you begin to realize, this body doesn't define me. There's some dynamic something inside of me. And once you begin to think that, you also expand, as I was saying. You embrace others and other realities unrelated to your body, unrelated to where your body came from or what it does or where it goes. It's a universal sympathy. Now, the process of human life, the real purpose of human life, is not just related to this one body. Now, we have to assume for purposes of this discussion, and these are the pieces I just have to throw in, that we've had more than one. Reincarnation is fundamental to this. So if you accept it, that makes it easier. If you don't, let's pretend, okay? A lot of this will still work whether you do or not, but some of the bigger explanations require it. So we've had bodies a lot of different times. We've lived in these bodies before, but there's something that is non-physically us, that just keeps going. You see it. You look in the mirror and you're surprised that you're staring at something that doesn't look like you remember yourself looking or feeling. And you just don't know what's happening, but you're just the same. So the process of human life, the purpose of life itself, is to expand our awareness. It's a very simple way to put it, to expand our awareness. Now, if you think about what looks like progress to you in any field, whether it's being an artist, a business person, in your relationships, in your family, just within yourself, everything is better the more aware you are. Isn't that so? And almost all your difficulties, if you really think about it, all come when you're not aware. Marie makes reference to what she called knee-jerk reactions, which is a very good phrase. I call them panic survival responses, where you just, even if you're very quiet, something in you has panicked, you think your life is at stake, and you respond without even thinking. Now, those things can ruin your life until you become aware of them. And then you become aware of a pattern. Steve raised the question of resentment. You know, you might not even know that you're being resentful. You might just think you have a righteous cause. And then you become more aware, or you become aware that something I'm doing seems to always poison the well, no matter how well-meaning I am. I never seem to end up where I want to be, and you try to become more aware. If you're trying to sing and you become aware of how to breathe properly, you can sing better. If you're trying to paint and you understand color, you can paint better. And so everything, even from childhood on, and all through the expansion of consciousness, which continues no matter how many bodies you have and in the spaces in between, it's all about expanding your awareness. Now, there is a question that raises, which is, how far could we expand our awareness? And the answer offered by the principles of self-realization, which is what we teach here, is to infinity. There is no limit. You are infinite, and all we have to do, I am infinite, we are infinite, and all we have to do is improve our knowing. We don't create any reality that doesn't already exist. We simply become more aware of it. How many times in our lives has everything shifted, not because anything actually changed, but because we became aware of things we didn't know? You know, there's lots of fairy tales about a pauper child who is really a king. And he lives as a pauper, and then he discovers that he's a king. Nothing has changed. He's just become aware of something he didn't know. How many times in your life have you ever felt weak or helpless or oppressed, maybe by somebody else? Maybe a few of you have mentioned bad relationships, maybe being caught in something that was really not good for your consciousness, and you didn't know it. But then you became aware that it was not good for you. Nothing has changed except your awareness. And then with that awareness often comes the awareness of the fact that, you know, I'm going to have courage. Things are going to be inconvenient. This may be hard. And all of those other awarenesses make you want to go back to sleep, don't they? How many times do we surface briefly and then sink again? You know, we vaguely realize that the man we married is an alcoholic, and then we pretend he's not. And sometimes it takes years before we really are willing to become aware, because we also have to be aware of everything else that means. So life is really when you just shrink it way down. Even all of the things that we teach here shrink way down to a very simple project. Either we are expanding our consciousness, or we are contracting it. We are either becoming more aware, or we are either not expanding or sometimes visibly contracting. But the fact of the matter is, if you're not going forward, you're going backwards. Because to live without expanding is, by very definition, to gradually die. And that's what you see in many people who are older, that they expanded to a certain point, and then it just got to be too much. The problems got to be too much, too many disappointments, too many recognition of things that it's not going to come out the way I thought, and then they'll just freeze at a certain point and then gradually go backwards. I had a ridiculous moment in my life when we first moved to Palo Alto, which was now about 16 years ago. And there, I was just, you know, finding my way around the way things go, and I had a bicycle, and I was just looking for things, and I wanted to go to the library, and there was a particular book I was looking for. And I hadn't been to the library very much, where I'd lived up in Nevada, at the Ananda community there, very small town, very small library. I just seldom went, but here, you know, libraries are huge. So I was going here to look for this book, and what I had in my mind was the card catalog in the oak boxes. I'm old enough to remember that, and I remember the wonderful feel of that oak box, and you'd ripple through the cards. I mean, it's like, it's so, like, not happening that it makes people chuckle. I feel like an old person even saying it. Well, I walked into the library, and I looked for the card catalog, and they pointed me to this bank of computers. Now I'm more computer savvy than I used to be, but I'm still fundamentally ignorant and reliant entirely on my friends. But I use computers all the time. I use my computer all the time. But I was much newer to it. And she points to this, and I go over and I sit down. And I mean, it's made for idiots, but I was sort of phobic about it. And I just couldn't make it work. And I was not having a good day. And there was just this sense of overwhelming tragedy that came over me. And the sense that I couldn't even find a book in the library. You know, nothing in my life was going well. You know how that is. And here I am at the library, and all I wanted was a book. And then I went out virtually in tears. And I walked out, and I'm about to get on my bicycle. And it's odd, the moments that come to you. It said, the voice inside of me said, if you don't go back and figure out how to use that computer, you're just going to continue to shrink from this point forward. I mean, it really was symbolic of the fact that I'm confronted with something I don't understand, and I become fearful and all self-concerned about how life hates me, and everyone hates me, including the library system, and I go out. But that's what we do, isn't it? And I said, children can operate this system. And I pretended I was six. And I walked in there like a six-year-old, and of course it was just a no-brainer. It was the easiest thing in the world. But we're always confronted with those choices. Do I face the fact that maybe I have a fault that I really have to consider here? Do I face the fact that I'm going to be terribly disappointed because this really isn't going to come out the way I thought? Or do I try to just somehow close back on that? Expansion or contraction? Now, the chakras are the system by which our consciousness keeps a record of what's going on in this expansion and contraction system. You know, you might ask the question, how does it happen? The body changes. In fact, the body dies. And we go to the astral world, and then we take a new body. And the new body still is a continuation of consciousness of where we left off at the old time. Swami Kriyananda was visiting here once, and he was here for the children's play. And the children had heard a lot about him because he's the founder of Ananda and the founder of the school they go to. And one of the little girls, children can be very cheeky. Adults were a little intimidated, but the child walked up and she said, how? And he's in his 70s, and he's not that old, but he looked down at her and he said, well, let's just put it this way. When you were an old woman, I was a little boy. And she sort of quite crossed her eyes for a minute, and then it kind of like went in. She got it. And she was very content. She walked off. That was a very good answer to her. You know, we're on this alternating cycle. I'm old, you're young, but when you were old, I was young, and then you left your body, and you started over, and then here we are. But there's something we call ourselves that continues through that. And that process of reincarnation, which is, of course, a whole other subject, which we are having classes on also, is why everybody's born different, and is why each of you has the nationality and the background and the circumstances you have, is because there was this force of energy and magnetism, which is the chakras, that brought you right to a certain point. Okay, so now let's talk about the chakras per se. Are you with me? Are there any questions that you need to ask before I zip on here? All right. The reality of infinity that we will someday realize, realizing the self, that's the concept of self-realization, the self with a capital S, we will realize the infinite self. That's the goal of life. Bear in mind, as I said a moment ago, we don't create that. It's not like it's not there and then suddenly, you know, we manufacture it. It's always there, we're just not aware of it. Just literally like we were thinking like this, and we just get bigger and bigger in our viewpoint. Or if the walls came down, if we could see out of the back of our head, whatever image you want. It's not that we have to make it, we just have to notice it. And so every time you are living, and every moment of your life, by your responses, by your thoughts, by your feelings, by your impulses, you and I'll include myself, we are always responding to life according to our sense of what's real, according to the reality that we're living in, right? If I had an aversion for people of other cultures, I could be responding right now with great anger and resentment because some of you don't look exactly like me. That would be a reality that I could respond from. Some of you may walk out of the street. I can go to Italy or to Germany or to Greece. Some may hate Americans, and they may attack me because I'm an American. because that the awareness that they live in causes them to respond to a certain reality. I would think that would be ridiculous, because my reality says, who cares where people come from? We're all children of God. We can also respond at different times. The lowest level of response, the most contracted level of response, starts from the body and is the most isolated. It starts from the physical reality, from the material level of reality. That's the most contracted form, because the more materially we define reality, the more separate we are, all one from another. Do you see? Because it is because we're physical that as much as I like you, there's just this sense of separation. There's no way that we can merge if we just look at our physical bodies. You know, we can smish up against each other, and if you're talking about relationships and love affairs and sexual affairs, we can smish up against each other as much as we want. A male and female can even interlink physically, but sooner or later it comes apart, right? Because physically it creates separation. So the most contracted concept of self starts with the body, and the more it stays with the body, the more contracted it remains. You know, speaking of women getting older, women who just mourn the loss of their youth or go to extreme, ridiculous extremes to maintain it. They think that they're physical, they don't understand that there's anything more, and it's a very, very contracted state of consciousness. I was in a health club in Dallas once, a very ritzy health club, and there was in the shower room, you know, people are changing their clothes, and there was a woman in front of me who you could see tried very hard to make her body strong, but it she wasn't youthful, I could tell, but when she turned around, I realized she was like 70, and she'd clearly had surgery and things like that, but my God, she was monstrous, because the difference between the reality of what her consciousness really was compared to the desperate effort she was trying to maintain to hold it through the body, it was grotesque. To my eye, it was grotesque. Probably when she had her clothes on and was all made up, it might not have been so, but just sort of stark naked like that, it was unbelievable. Okay, so that's the lowest level. Now, we can respond from that level without being that garish. If somebody wants to take the last half of the sandwich and I want it, you know, it's like, if you eat it, I don't get it, so I want it. Or if you're driving down the street, or you're walking down the street and suddenly a car looks like it's about to hit you, and you think something's going to happen to your body, and you get very afraid. That's also an affirmation that I am the body. And if something happens to this body, I have reason to be scared. A friend of mine recently was in a car crash, and she was rear-ended by a truck. And it was one of those pile-ups on the freeway, slow down on the freeway, and so she had a moment sitting there where she looked up in her rearview mirror. There was no place for her to go. She looked in her rearview mirror and she saw the truck coming so fast that she knew he was about to hit her. And as she said, she was very proud of herself, because she let go of the wheel, she shut her eyes, and she began to chant to the guru, Om Guru, Om Guru, Om Guru. It was like, instead of, you know, curving in protectively, she just let go of that level of reality and just went to a level of reality that was going to be beyond what was about to happen. And in fact, she wasn't seriously hurt, because airbags all over the place went off and protected her, and she was in one of those big cars. But nonetheless, that's a moment. Like, what do I do? Oh my God, what's going to happen to me? Or in moments like that, you say, what about my children? What about my husband? What about my house? Whatever it might be that pulls us back, that's all defined by this body. Or we can say, I am the infinite spirit. I was just living in this body for a while anyway, take it away, who cares? And it's a very great state of consciousness to be able to respond just like that. Often when people have time to think about it, like time to know they're dying, they can release it more easily. But at the same time, you can see that that's the spectrum that we're presenting. Either we cling to what's physical, or we recognize that I am just spirit, just acting through this body, so who cares? And that's what makes us generous. That's what makes us say, I'll take care of you as happily as I'll take care of me. Maybe we don't have to sacrifice our lives, but we give our time, our money, our energy, our commitment, our creativity. I mean, parenting teaches us to completely identify with something other than ourselves. It's not as big as infinity, but it's a lot bigger than just me. And some people start. That's why God gives us families, because we start realizing there's more than just me. And then we go from families to communities to countries to nations to infinity. And every step of the way, we're always making a choice. What is real to me? Who am I? What is real? Am I physical? Am I material? Where does my happiness come from? And it's from, I am one with the infinite, therefore I live equally in all of creation, in all bodies. What happens to one is the same as what happens to me, or I have to protect myself. Right? Now that represents a spectrum. And that spectrum is the spectrum of the chakras. Okay? Now the chakras are vortices of energy, which I point on the body, that run through the center of the body. And there's seven chakras, counting the one at the top of the head. And I guess I have a little chart here I can put up to speak about. I don't have to draw it. And I'm not going to deal with almost anything on this chart except just the physical facts here. But the chakras are not physical. The chakras are energy. There's no chakra in the physical body. Someone wrote to me once that they had had a hysterectomy and they'd been told that their second chakra had been removed and they were very nervous. Okay, I said, no surgeon, no matter how skillful, could ever cut out your chakra, believe me, because it isn't there. We actually are, the reason that this physical body is alive is because there is an energy body called the astral body or the energy body, which lives inside of it. And then within the astral body, there's a more subtle body, which is called the causal body. But mostly it's the astral and the material that we work with mostly. The astral is the energy body. When you die, this body is so not you, it's so obvious to everyone who has any sensitivity at all. If you've ever been with somebody who dies, they are there acting through that body. When the body stops breathing, there's not even an inclination to relate. Where all of your energy has been focused around this dying person, as soon as the soul exits, it's like you could care less. It's become like a piece of the bed, a pillow, a blanket. It just doesn't have any force. Because we realize there's this animating energy. And if you've watched any movies that deal with after-death stories now, they're doing a wonderful job of illustrating it for us, aren't they? The bodies die, it's murdered, it's hit by a car, or whatever happens. And what you see is the same actors, slightly translucent, sort of rising out of the corpse and kind of going around, floating around, being exactly themselves, but they're not physical anymore. They can't touch the physical world. And they're not bound by it in the same way. They can move around, they can see things. It's very accurate, actually. Although most of the time you don't hang around Earth, you go on to the worlds within other worlds where everyone and everything is subtle like that. Until such time as you need to have a physical body, and then you come back into somebody's womb and you make another one. Okay, now the chakras belong to the astral body. The chakras belong to the energy body. And the pattern, just like if you had a card file or a computer is a more apt example, although I don't understand them well enough to draw the example exactly. But every time you do something, every time you put out any kind of energy, and everything you do is about energy, your thoughts, your feelings, it doesn't matter if it manifests all the way to physical energy, thought is also energy. Emotion is energy. It doesn't go away. Because of the ego, because of the thought that I am doing it, it stays with the place where I am located, which is the astral and the physical body. Now, the lowest chakra is the earth chakra, and it represents the material world, the physical world. The highest chakra, for purposes of this discussion, is really the point between the eyebrows. There is a chakra at the crown center also, but this chakra is the integration of the individual self with the infinite. So every time you do something and make a comment or respond, if you could measure its vibration, you could say, this was 95% an affirmation of physical reality. This was half an affirmation of physical reality, a little bit of an understanding of energy. So it goes a little higher up the spine. This was a very loving gesture, but it was still related to me as a person, so it gets up to the heart. It gets up to the throat chakra, and it begins to say, this was really about expanding beyond my sense of self altogether. If it gets all the way up to the spiritual eye, it's an understanding that I am one with the infinite spirit. So every time you act, and every time you have ever acted in any of your incarnations, you've registered energy in the appropriate chakra. Now, the thing about the chakras is, like, Nobody's in charge. Nobody's doing it to you. You know, there's no CEO of this company who could twist the facts about it. It's absolutely related to what you have done. And it's vibratory. It's not opinion. It's not even what you think you're doing. It's what your action actually reflects, what premises your actions actually reflect. So as you go on in this life, it's like if you think about it, it's like little banks. You put coins in those banks every time you act. If you habitually act from a very loving, heart-centered reality that yet still is somewhat based on the gratification it gives you, and I mean, you're a good person, you're a loving person, but there's still a little bit of emotional involved in it. That's the heart. The throat is more expansive than that. I'm just using these quickly as examples. You would have a lot of energy at the heart. And maybe you are really generous. You don't generally grab for yourself. So the lower chakras in their negative aspect are not as big. If somebody looked at you, they'd see a lot of heart energy emanating. Maybe you're less heart-oriented. Maybe you have a lot of will, which is also, I don't want you to think of these too much as just 1, 2, 3, 4. But the will energy is here at the navel chakra. This is personal power. Maybe the strength of your nature is that you're very powerful. And so you develop a lot of energy right at this chakra. And if people could see you, which some people can, or feel with their hands, they would feel that there's more or less energy in different places. Now, all of that energy is your magnetism. And your magnetism really is your karma and is your fate. Because this is an energy universe. And this is all these different forces of energy playing against each other. It attracts, it repels, it guides you, it causes you to make decisions just basically on whatever this collection of vibrations is. You meet vibrations that are similar to yours. You are pushed away from vibrations that are negative. You meet vibrations that are familiar. Why are we attracted to people? Why do we like some people and not like others? Sometimes we have great resonance with someone that turns out not to be healthy for us, but it was a resonance that we had, and therefore there was a melding. The vibrations were the same. It's other energies that might be much better for you, but you're not yet vibrating on that level. You'll meet those and you won't quite be able to pull it together until you change your magnetism sufficiently to make it melt. Now, does that in general concept make sense? Are there any questions or comments? Now, every single day, every moment, waking or sleeping, you are affecting the energy of these chakras, and these chakras are affecting you. In fact, these chakras define you. You're not really your body or nationality or anything. You are the pattern of energy in your chakras. Just as a sidelight without explaining it, astrology is based on the chakras. That's why if astrologers are very good, because the pattern of the chakras is also reflected in the stars. And when they're reading the stars correctly, the astrology and the science of yoga and the science of the chakras were the same science. Because it was a way of looking externally. The moment you chose to be born is reflective of the energy inside of you. Because this whole universe is intercreated. I don't want to go on a sidelight. I just want to throw that out to tease you. Yes, Tom?
Is that a sense that given your sign that you're working on that chakra?
It's more subtle than that. It's much more subtle than that. Okay? Because, see, most astrologers don't read it subtly. Most astrologers are too materialistic in their definition of it, and they no longer know it's related to the chakras. But that's why astrology can work, is because there's a relationship there.
I'm curious too about multiple lives, and in the sense that people are born in situations that appear to me they have no control over. So is the explanation that
it only appears to you that they had no control over it?
Well, this is what I'm saying, that the energy of your chakras before lead you in, like the Middle East, you picture you're growing up as a youngster and you're being taught this hate.
Yeah, but you wouldn't be there, or you wouldn't be responding to it unless, I mean, now the lesson can go both ways. You can either be there because you're in tune with it and you want more of it, or you can be there because you're growing out of it and you need to have it made so obvious that you don't want this, that you're often drawn into situations not because you want them, but because you're really ready to transcend them. But if it's not made really bad, you won't notice it. You see? Now, see, what the chakras represent also is what you might call unlearned lessons. The place you're trying to go in all of this is to infinite consciousness. Now, that doesn't mean you don't still live, and this is where, I'm not going to be able to say everything, so I'm going to have to just give you ideas. Every chakra has the positive expression of it and also the negative expression of it. Or I would phrase it differently. There's an expansive direction for that energy to go, and there's a contractive direction for the energy to go. Now, that's very important. I have to keep shifting the balance. It's not just these are bad chakras, these are good chakras. Not at all. It's that every chakra has a vibratory reality that can either be used expansively or that can be used contractively. Okay? And the way you might say it is that the quality of the chakra can be directed in a way that raises your consciousness upward, or it can be expressed horizontally and just drained out on a level that will just keep you trapped on that level. People talk about chakras being blocked, but actually what chakras are is they have holes in them. Okay? It's not that the energy is blocked from rising because it's leaking out. Okay? Because we do have physical bodies, we do have to live in this world, we do have material realities, we do have to relate to them. Now, do we relate to the fact that we have physical bodies and that we're in this material world in such a way that our consciousness is gradually expanded, or do we relate to it in such a way that it keeps us bound on this level? You see? And literally, the way the energy flows is you want the energy to flow through this chakra, so blocked is the right word also, through this chakra back up to a higher level, and then that quality of energy is expressed from a higher level. And if we're very materialistic, very sexually oriented, very selfishly willful, very emotional, then the energy that is in these chakras just keeps coming out on this level, so to speak. We use our willpower to try to have power over others, and we're just always bullying and trying to make things happen instead of using our willpower to understand what is true, to discipline ourselves, to help uplift others, to create beautiful things. You see the difference? And it's the same energy. It's the energy of willpower emanating from this individual's consciousness. But do I use it to expand myself and others? Or do I use it to just keep affirming what I am right now? Do I use my sexual and creative energy, again, in ways that are appropriate to create loving relationships, to create stable families, to create beautiful, beautiful things? Or do I just use it for self-indulgence continuously? And just create only when there's something in it for me, or become very sensually oriented or promiscuous and irresponsible or frozen, frigid and not even kind in my sexuality. I mean, there's all these different ways to say it. Those are all taking that energy and not using it properly. Okay? So what you want to do is you need to be integrated. You need to have each of these chakras understood and functioning beautifully within you. Because especially when you take these five, and then add it in balance with the sixth one here, it actually creates the picture of a balanced human being. Okay, now you had a question, Kai. Did I answer it, or did I?
I was curious.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I can verbalize this. If one has physical pain, mm-hmm. it seems to be located very distinctly at a specific chakra,
right.
Would that be?
Not necessarily. It's far too simplistic. A lot of what people teach about chakras is much too simplistic and doesn't take into account how subtle these energies are. So I was going to go somewhere that would answer that question. So let me... There are many, many different ways to describe each chakra. And you see all these different sort of things up on this chart and others on this chart, including... Here's the astrological side of it. All of this is just to tease you. Buy another tape, okay? So I'm just going to give you, and whenever we talk about the chakras, I go with a certain image, and then I erase that one, and I flip it, and I start another image. Some of them, all of these are just trying to explain the unexplainable. So sometimes they're a little inconsistent, and I try to just say, forget that one for now. Let's work with this. The chakras, as I started to say, and this is the point I wanted to put out now, you can call them earth, air, fire, water, ether. Ether isn't like the gas that you take like this. It's the substance of the universe. It's a sort of arcane word. And those are pretty good ones. And each of those represent certain qualities that every human being has and needs, and then we decide which direction those qualities go. So just to skip a little bit, Kaya, an answer to your question, it's not so much where it's located for you to have an understanding of what it's doing for you. It's what qualities and what challenges the pain presents for you. Because it may be located near the second chakra or near the first chakra, but it may really have to do with qualities of the heart. So it's not so much where it is in the physical body, is where it falls on the spectrum of what the chakras represent. Okay, that's where that system breaks down. The first chakra, being the earth chakra, represents the need for security, the need for stability, the need for loyalty. And Yogananda says the phrase, loyalty is the first law, the first divine law. Because, and it's an esoteric reference to the fact that the first chakra is the vibration of loyalty. Now the question is, what are we loyal to? Because negatively expressed, that loyalty can be very narrow and contractive. I'm going to look out for number one. And also very contractively expressed, it's like, I need security. I need money. I need a house. I need somebody who's going to depend on me. I need a job. I'm just going to make a little world that nobody can touch. And that's first chakra energy, because it's looking for security. And if it misunderstands or if it's contractive, it looks for security in all the wrong places. Now, it's not the quest for security that's wrong, because the fundamental quality of the earth chakra and of the first chakra, it's where we direct that need for security. Do we try to do it by imposing our will on others and making the universe conform? Or are we loyal to truth? Are we loyal to divine principles? Are we loyal to our spiritual aspirations? Are we loyal to our determination to expand our consciousness? Now, you can see that if you don't have the capacity to be loyal, then life gets a little confusing, doesn't it? Now, I'm going to mention the word relationships, which we're all supposed to talk about also. Just think about relationships. If you don't have the capacity to commit yourself, or someone else doesn't have the capacity to commit to you, you can see how that's a very fundamental problem, isn't it? Because that's the foundation. Loyalty is the first law, right? Okay, and at the same time, the first chakra is about feeling secure. So if you are trying to get your security by the fact that this person is going to be here for me, and he or she is going to be certain ways, and as long as they're certain ways, I'm fine. But as soon as they're not that ways, all this agitation develops in the first chakra, in essence, and then you try to make them be that way for you. But the difficulty is, which you all may have experienced, people have just a really impressive habit of doing whatever they damn well please, don't they? Right? No matter how clearly you explain it to them, no matter how much you say in just the right words, I need you to be this way. And they can't necessarily, it's not necessarily because they're trying to hurt you. It's because they're as trapped as you are. And this is a whole other aspect of relationships. They're as trapped as you are by the forces within them. They may have a very idea from the heart, which is the air element, which might be a very airy idea of, I love you, I'm going to be kind to you forever, but they lack the stability of the earth. So they make that promise with all this, but there's nothing underneath it, because they've worked a lot with the air. They flow. They feel things. They just like to go with the flow. And yes, I love you, I love you, I love you, but there's no earth under it. And you can see that it's not enough to have all this wonderful heart, air, energy, because if there's nothing to anchor it, there's always something wrong. All of you have experienced this in yourself and others. So this is the beginning of sort of seeing how very, like, practical this is. And I'm going to just take a little moment to sort of explain this. I myself never paid any attention to the chakras for 15 years of the 30 years I've been on the path. Maybe 10 of the 30. Because it always seemed just too far out there. I'm a very practical person. I'm a very, like, you know, so what about what's happening on the seventh ray of the eighth dimension of the ninth manifestation of? It's like I have to get up this morning and do something with my life. And finally, once I heard, finally Swami Kriyananda actually took on the subject, and he explained it like this. And the way that I'm starting to explain it to you, you need to be loyal. You're having a search for security. The chakras get very pragmatic. And one of the ways you find out what's going on in your chakras is you look at your life, right? And as we finish this, you'll see that each of these chakras represents very fundamental qualities. If you see in your life that I have so much love in my heart, but I don't have any strength behind it, I don't have any willpower behind it, I don't have any creativity behind it, I don't have any grounded loyalty behind it, then you can see you don't need to work anymore on developing your heart. You just need to make promises and keep them, you know, to yourself and to others, because that's where your system is weak. And you can also use various exercises that you will find in the Chakras Handbook, and a little bit which you'll get from me today, to strengthen the first chakra. I am steadfast, determined, unshakably loyal to truth. That's the affirmation that goes with the first chakra. And so you might be having a terrible time in your life, you know, staying where you know you need to be, always getting blown around by the air forces in you. So you just start meditating, I am steadfast, determined, unshakably loyal to truth. And every morning you affirm that, and you're not doing anything about the fact that you're not getting along with your family, but you may find that you'll start getting along with your family if the difficulties are created from here. Do you see what I mean? So sometimes we can't get at it this way because it's too difficult, but we change this internal pattern and our entire inclination will be different. Okay, does that make sense? So that's how this gets extremely practical in this matter. So, first chakra is earth, it's loyalty. The other thing the other negative expression of that chakra is to be just too narrow, and you can become fanatical and just become loyal to some very tiny idea that you have. Like I see, with all due respect, because I'm a woman, I can say this. You know, a lot of women are very loyal to the fact that I am going to get it the way I want it, right? Which is okay, and not completely untrue, but it's a little bit of a narrow thing to be loyal, because one chakra alone won't do it. You have to sort of have them all working together to make it work. It's not a bad idea in itself, but if you become too loyal to that, you might mess up a lot of other things that you want. Now, do we have any questions? If not, we'll take a short break. Any questions or comments? Oh, yes, Tom. Yes, Bin Laden. Bin Laden is loyal, but he's not loyal to an expansive ideal. So what he has a lot of this energy. He has first chakra energy, and he's been pretty creative in the way he's handled it. He's used a lot of willpower, but he doesn't have a lot of heart. You know, and he certainly doesn't have an expansive awareness, and his concept of God is pretty weird. Okay? Right? But he's got a few things together. No, I mean, you have to say it like that. And you have to think about yourself that, yeah, he's got certain things. He's just way too contractive. And so he's going to have some hard lessons before he gets what the rest of the story is, like all the rest of us. Okay, let's take a 10-minute break. Or slightly less than 10. Be back at, that clock says 15, so be back at 25 after. Any questions or comments before we go galloping onward?
Yes, sir. As we were talking a little bit after the first half, I find, you mentioned that there's so many different ways of describing the chakras.
Yeah.
And it's funny, I too, for many years, just kind of ignored the chakras entirely and started to pay attention. But what I find is that at times, certain of the illustrations are very, very helpful, even something so simple as earth, air, water. Just an example, I mean, for instance, for some of us who perhaps at times have a little trouble lightening up. Just the concept of even thinking in terms of, well, perhaps I need to inject a little more air into my consciousness in the moment, even just to focus really on that place of air.
No, it's very true. That, I mean, that what Steve is describing is how you take something that seems very esoteric, and it's not really esoteric at all. Because at any moment in your life, you are reflecting these vibrations. And if if you're not having a good time, it's because in some way you're out of balance. And you ask yourself, how am I out of balance? Now, you might not have been having a good time for the last 27 years, and you need to say, like, how am I massively out of balance? Or it might just be you're having a bad morning. You know, you're faced with something you don't think you can deal with. I mean, it's not always that you need to lighten up. Sometimes you need to toughen up. You know, what is really required in this situation? Thinking in terms of relationships, which we'll get more in now in this part of it. You know, sometimes hard energy is okay, but sometimes you just need a little fire. I talked about being too stubborn and stuck in your ways. Sometimes people are too nice. They're too nice, and they're not being loyal to the truth as they know it. And it's not enough merely in an airy sort of way to say, that's not very nice. Sometimes you need to say, get out, and get out now. And it's not necessarily the wrong thing to do. Because maybe out of loyalty to this truth, you simply need the fire to do it, and it's just being nice is not an expansive direction for you. Because you're all out of balance here. Or maybe you're a little bit too much fire. A little bit too much, always standing up for your own truth. And maybe you just need to get a little more space in things, or a little more flow in the water chakra. Maybe the earth is just, and the fire are just fine, but we need to douse this with a little water. That certainly is where I stand in my life. If there's any like sort of mantra of my husband, it's just like, he never actually says it, but you see it in his poor beleaguered eyes. Cool out, woman, you know, just chill out. Like, lots of fire and lots of loyalty, but let's just let it flow a little bit. He once said to me, do you ever let anything just, like, go by? You know, do you have to, like, respond to everything? He was like, oh, what a concept. Because everybody's different. But in my first marriage, oddly enough, which no one believes, absolutely no one believes, I have living witnesses, but they seldom come around. I wasn't like that at all. I just allowed my sort of capacity to just like him just take me everywhere. It took me way, way far away from myself and where I wanted to be. And I didn't have any fire, and I allowed his influence to compromise things that were fundamental to my nature. And so I'm still 30 years later, 20 years into this marriage, just a teeny weeny bit still protective on that issue. Maybe it's time to put it down. Maybe enough is enough. But you can see, it just depends on who you are. Now, in this relationship, I don't need to work anymore on that kind of strength. I've been there, now I have done that. You know, to hold this marriage together, I need to back off of that. If I had been more loyal to myself, because my first husband was a very nice man, mean to do that to me, we were just too young. He didn't know he was doing it. He didn't know at all that he was doing it. I did. It was my responsibility to speak up. But I didn't have the strength of character or the fire, the courage that I needed at that point. You see how different it is? And then there was a long interlude, and then I married David, and it's a whole different need. I fought him so much more than I ever needed to that I finally have had to realize I've got a way back off of that. I've mastered that. Now I've gone too far. It's always a question of, you know, trying to find the balance point down the middle. That's why you can say, what's going on in my life? That tells me what's going on in my chakras. And then you can work on it in your life, and then you can work on it in your chakras. I have handouts here, because Kaya had the good sense to ask me if we had them, that have essentially this chart, have another chart that has all the detailed aspects of the chakras, just for fun. And it also has all the affirmations that go with each chakra. Right, and a little bit of guidance about how to work with them, so that when you take what I'm telling you and think about it, you can sort of say, well, I really need to strengthen this dimension of my nature, and here's a real direct way to do it. Okay? Any other questions or thoughts or comments? Okay, what's fun about the chakras in terms of relationships is that it really does work. It really has basically what you need. So I've started by describing the earth element is this steadfast loyalty, the ability to give your word and keep it, which is... Now, none of these stand alone. You can't just become perfect first chakra person and that's all you need, because it is these five chakras that then are guided from the sixth chakra. When I finally get up here, I'll talk about the seventh and explain it. So you really need them all. And the perfection of each chakra relies upon the perfection of the others, because at certain times certain things are needed. So you have earth, which is really great. It has this strong force, but the trouble with earth is that it isn't as mutable it doesn't change that quickly. You know, we've talked about the physical body changing, but it changes over a very long period of time. Physical things do decay and shift, but not quickly. Whereas life requires of us that we have a very creative capacity. And the second chakra is often associated with sexuality, but even behind sexuality, more fundamental than sexuality, is creativity. And it's the second chakra is the water chakra. And the water chakra in relation to the first chakra is very interesting, because first chakra energy keeps its form. It knows its reality no matter what. Now, as I said, in a narrow sense, that's a physical form, but in a higher sense, it knows what's true. The first chakra says, my life is dedicated to God, for example, and even though I'll love my family and I'll take care of business, that's my first premise. Or perhaps less grand than that, you know, I will not be with someone who will take advantage of me in certain ways. I know I hear women say things that are not my issues, but, you know, I will not put up with physical abuse. I won't accept if he lies to me. He must be faithful to me, or whatever those things are. But these are my truths, and I'm going to hold to them. That's my bottom line. And it's very helpful, actually, in relationships to know your bottom line, just by the way. I was married. I had almost 10 years of being single, and then I married David. And during those 10 years, I really got clear on what my bottom line was. And I didn't know. And many, many, many things, almost everything in a relationship can be compromised, except your core values. If you compromise your core values, you lose your relationship and you lose yourself. And when I, in between my relationships, and I never thought I would marry again, I was just trying to figure out what I was about, I really had to think, because my first husband was a very good man, and we had a wonderful rapport on many levels. But he did not share my core values as they really had developed in me. Now, they're very specific. Mine is not a generalized spiritual commitment. I have a deep commitment to Ananda. I have a deep commitment to Swami Kriyananda. I have an absolute need to have the freedom to do what I think I have to do. And that includes, in my particular nature, the ability to give away my time, my money, my possessions, if I feel that I have to. And actually, when I thought about it, that's all that I need. I thought I needed a lot of other things, or wanted a lot of other things, but I realized everything else is superficial, but I have to have that. And in the marriage that I was in before, he was off on a different path, and he didn't respect mine. He was more contractive in his ways of thinking, and he wanted to control my life more than I could allow it to be controlled. And it was a marriage buster, right? Nothing else that we seem to be arguing about really was a marriage buster, just that. With the husband I have now, there's no question. I mean, it's just from day one to the present day, there's just no threat to those things. He likes to vacation in cities. I like to go to quiet places. You know, he's essentially an introvert, so when he wants to go on holiday, he likes to be active. I'm so extra. When I go on holiday, I want to be quiet. You know, we don't share a taste in movies. He doesn't sing, and I always wanted to marry a musician. He can't fix anything in the house, which I thought would be so nice. You know, when you first meet us, now we've both come closer to the center, but when we first married, it seemed like such a marriage of opposites. He was just so quiet and so different than me. People couldn't understand it, but they didn't get that underneath what really mattered, and there was and always has been this kind of energy, many, many personality issues. I'm so talkative. I so love to discuss things, and he simply, in very simple words, doesn't. It's as simple as that. He doesn't. You know, that can drive him. He doesn't get my humor. I mean, he does sometimes, but I love words. I love to play with words. And he just stares at me like, woman, what are you talking about? You know, like, and I sometimes say to myself, I married someone like this who can't, like, you know, understand these tiny nuances of letters. And it's like, what have I done? But I know exactly what I've done. None of that matters. None that makes any difference. Those are my core values. I'm absolutely loyal to them. I would give up everything for them. Right? Everything else is superficial. So that's what you have to know. But you have to be creative in your application with it, and you have to learn to flow. What does it really look like? I mean, you know, to be loyal to these particular things. And that's, David has taught me a lot. My idea of what it was to be loyal to my spiritual path was I was an impoverished nun. When he met me, you know, just an impoverished nun, a homely impoverished nun. And he's like a king. That's just his way of relating to the world. To me, it's like poverty is spiritual, materialism is bad. And, you know, I had all these categories of life. You know, this is spiritual, this isn't, this is spiritual, this isn't. He didn't have any of those categories. They totally bewildered him. To him, it was just a flow of energy. You know, if you're building a house, you build a beautiful house. If you're camping, you camp. If you're rich, you're rich. And if you're poor, you're poor. He just didn't see it anyway. And I had loyalty, but my loyalty was so rigid. And I remember, people love this, but when I first started living with him, I, you know, came from this renunciate lifestyle. And I'd been there about 2 months, and he opened the closet one day, and he said, "Can we throw away all your clothes?" I said, "Well, if you buy me new ones, not a problem." So we just threw away all my clothes, because they're all ugly. And, you know, to him it was fine. To me it was like, all right, okay, we can do that. But it was like, I can, you know, be nice looking, and I'm not compromising my core principles, because he was very creative in his expression of it. And he could see, and I like this example, you know, you hold up this water, the water element, water assumes whatever form it is. Right now, water looks like a glass. You go down to a river, water looks like river. You go to the ocean, the water looks like ocean. You pour it on the rug, and the water looks like rug. You know? But it's still water. Everyone knows it, and somebody's probably going to have to clean it up, but there it is, because it's still water. And so that's, if you have earth element in place, when form changes, you don't feel threatened. You see? But if you don't have earth element, you things change around you. If you don't have earth element in balance, either you have to cling to the form and it just can't be different, or you might just flow all the time. You know, you're just into love, and so you're just love this one, and you love that one, and you love this one, and you love that one, because you don't have form clear enough. You've got too much of the water. And also, for relationships to work, you have to always reinvent them. I read a very interesting article by somebody had the sense to study marriages that actually worked instead of always studying marriages that didn't work. And it was interesting, and I really related to it. I'm 20 years now with David. They said that they have reinvented their marriage multiple times. That the marriage they have now is not the same marriage that they started with. And in very real sense, the marriage they divorced, but never actually divorced. I mean, they ended that marriage and then started another one. Because if you're growing and expansive in yourself, you have to figure out how to do that. And so you have to be creative, and that's what water does. You were still married, it's still water, but it looks extremely different than it did when we started. And very often we get stuck because you used to always do this for me. You know, she used to always take care of me like this. But now she is bored spending all the time in the house and she needs to go out and do something. But he says, but that's not marriage. Marriage is when you do this. Or she's used to him taking care of her in a certain way. What will happen to us if you feel you have to go follow this particular reality? Will it still be the same? So you have to have that creative expression. Sexuality is also represented by this. And you can see also how sexuality, if it's not loyal and strong, and there needs to be a creative expression in your affection for each other, you know, without drawing too fine a sexual point on it, but you have to be creative in your expression of one another, in your affection for one another. You can't just fall into habits. You can't just sort of always be the same. This is the way it is. You have to really freshly see each other every single day. David and I joke a lot about, you know, I'm always training him because women are always training men, but I'm training him always in a sort of lighthearted way. You know, see how I kiss you when I first come in? Isn't that nice? You know, and I encourage you to kiss me when you first come in, because really it's a very efficient thing for you to do. Because if you just do that, you will find I am so cheerful. But even if that becomes perfunctory, it has to be a creative expression constantly. And many marriages, there's nothing really wrong with them except one or both parties stop putting out any new energy. And time has passed and we're still living in the past. And we lose the second chakra, just sink into the first without anything. Okay, does that make sense? Any questions or comments? Marilyn, I'm nervous about this water. Will it be all right? Okay, thank you. I used to do that when there was this old brown rug in here. This is the first time I've ever poured water on this blue rug, and it made me... No, if you think it's fine, it's probably fine. Yeah, we worried when we remodeled this room what would happen to all our habits. Now, the third chakra is the fire chakra. Okay, Okay, this is represented here. These chakras, just for your information, the first chakra roughly corresponds to where the anus is in the body. It's at the very base of the spine. Now, bear in mind, the spine is not these knobs that you feel here. The spine is like a rod that goes the astral spine is like a rod that goes down from the top of your head, as if this thing was constructed and there had to be this pole first upon which it was constructed, which is, in fact, exactly how it is. When the sperm and the ovum come together in the first cell, it's right here at the medulla. This is the seat of self, the seat of the ego. It's the one part of the body they can't operate on. If you have a tumor there, you know, it can take your life away, because this is the seat of your life. And the little pictures, I saw a little book once, Your Developing Embryo, and the first thing that shows is something that's like a little toothpick. It's just like the little baby, the first thing that happens is a little toothpick is made, because from the medulla, the spine is made. And then from the spine, then that's the chakras, each of the chakras. And then the chakras are the concentration of subtle energy that then manifests the physical energy. So in relation to the places in the body where the chakras are, they're also concentrations of physical nerves and energy. And they're not the chakras, but they're there because the chakras on the astral form are there. So that's where the energy emanates from. So it's like a rod going down the center of your body. So when you visualize it, you visualize it in the center. Okay, and this is the first chakra at the very base of the spine. And if you tense the anus, you can sort of like locate it physically. The second chakra is located approximately where the sexual organs are. And again, if you tense the sexual organs, it locates it physically. But go in deeper. Don't just sort of sit on the outside of the body. The third chakra is your navel. And this is where the concept of contemplating your navel comes from. Okay? Now, bear in mind, I'm just going to throw this in. I'll get to this more clearly later. But even when you're energizing these chakras, you want to concentrate most of your energy at the spiritual eye, or simultaneously, because you don't want to be strengthening these chakras on their own level so much as you want to be gathering that energy to draw it up. That's a little subtle without explaining it more, but I'll come back to it. The third chakra is the fire chakra. Now, you might have loyalty, you might even have creativity, but if you don't have any energy and willpower, nothing ever comes of it, right? So a lot of times we look at our lives and we see that we have all the good intentions in the world, we have all the right values, and we have all the ideas that we need, but we don't have any fire behind it. And so we can see that I don't need to sort of think of more ideas or make myself more loyal to things. I just need to get moving. And fire is transformative. Fire can take physical things and transform them into something else. It can break up form completely. So in the progression as we go from earth, first earth is just fixed, water flows, fire transforms. And so the key chakras in the reality of it are the third chakra and the fourth chakra. Because you have to be able to have enough fire to pull this energy up and start transforming it to something higher. You have to be able to use it. And so the third chakra is willpower. Now, when we get into relationships, willpower is a tricky business. Because you have to use your willpower in the right way to do the right things. And you can be in relationships, again, with all the right intentions, but if you don't have enough willpower to really adjust to reality, to really work on yourself, and also, there's always this clash of willpower. And so the fire energy has to be balanced with what am I really trying to accomplish here? What are my core values? And how creative am I? How fluid am I in the understanding of it? But then that has to come in. And if you know, if you're with someone or you yourself, you mean well, you want to love them, you want to do the things, you know it's important, but you just don't have any fire. And maybe what you really need to work on is just developing energy. Energy directed by whatever it is that you believe in. Or you have so much fire, but it has no foundation. It doesn't have any core value. It's just exploding left and right in all sorts of situations, to a certain extent, depending on, you know, what the actual issue is, but the kind of, quote, knee-jerk responses can be fire just run amok. And a lot of what's going on in relationships now is a lot of women are developing a lot of fire, which is really all to the good. But we're not exactly clear as to what our core values are that we're trying to assert. And sometimes the fire that we're using is too much to support our point of view and our need as women to stand up and be treated a certain way without really understanding what the implications of that are. And what I see left and right, and I have lots of, I used to do a lot more, but I've done a lot of marriage counseling in my life. I'll have women come to me, and there's nothing wrong with what they're saying, except that they're going to be single for their whole lives. So I say, you know, that's a fine idea, you can have that idea, but you will go into divorce court with that idea. Because if you're just using your fire to try to burn up his reality, you're going to burn up his reality, but he'll have to take it somewhere else. So we have to really learn to use the fire to balance and use it more to discipline ourselves than we do to try to just impose it on the world. The wrong expression of fire energy is that it's destructive. And that is, a fire run wild is destructive. The right energy of the fire is like a crucible that burns out all the impurities and then just leaves the pure gold. But the impurities we're trying to burn up are the impurities of our own wrong understanding. Now, this is the trickiest part. You know, fire and willpower is one of the trickiest parts of relationship. Because we're so trained, once we develop a certain amount of willpower, we just have a tendency to use it. We have a tendency to use it on the world around us. And we may realize, we may feel that our security is threatened. And that's what I was calling my panic survival response. And over the years that I've been married to David, who is a patient, saintly person, thank God, or else we would not be married anymore. There were so many things before I really understood what was happening to me. There were so many things that I felt threatened my security. That whenever he would happen to be the instrument of something that I thought would threaten my security, I would use the strength of the fire in my nature to try to protect myself from that apparent threat. Now, that threat could include things like him having a different opinion than me, him having a desire to make a decision. We worked together all these years. Him having a desire to, you know, make a certain decision for the work that we're doing that I would see as a decision that I didn't want. And then I would use my fire to try to just put, you know, to burn up. Except, unfortunately, that comes across like you're trying to burn up that person, right? Or they may not have the detachment and the wherewithal to realize that you're just talking about ideas. They naturally feel personally threatened by that. And a lot of times, now this is all about security. If your first chakra's sense of security is too externally oriented, then when external things threaten that sense of security, you try to destroy them with fire. So you have to stand back and say, what am I afraid of? And I had to go through myself a very long process of just asking myself, what am I really afraid of? What do I really think is going to happen here? And that was my, you know, what if I just did nothing? Now, of course, I had the experience of a previous marriage in which I did nothing. And when I finally did something, I was a forest fire out of control, and it was just hopeless, right? It was like there hadn't been any, like, controlled burns for enough years that when finally the spark went in, everything just went up like crazy. So, like, I had a marriage that was just fine until it blew up. Like, there was nothing wrong with it until it was over. I was so weird. It took me years to understand what had gone on there. So, I've been doing a lot of controlled burns since then. But sometimes the fire goes a little too close, and it's not fun for anybody around you. Does that make sense? Now, this is one of the hardest things to understand for a number of reasons. One is, it's very hard to be aware enough to know what you're actually doing. It's just, and that's where self-awareness, which is where we started, self-understanding. The most important way to prepare for relationships is know thyself. The more you know yourself, the more you actually understand what you're doing and why you're doing it, whatever it might be, the more chance you have in relationships. 99% of the problems in relation are a person doesn't really know what's moving them, and they think it has something to do with the other person. They don't know, as someone said to me, where their pain is coming from. If you don't know where your pain is coming from, and you experience it every time that person does something, it will naturally occur to you that they are causing it. You know, they do it, I hurt, they do it, I hurt. How can you think any other than they are hurting me, right? But you have to think much more carefully and realize that it's I who am responding to their actions in such a way that it hurts me. And it's almost always because there's a threat involved. And where does the threat come from? From too narrow an idea of where my security is, from not being creative enough. And then fire becomes your enemy. On the other hand, when fire is your friend, fire is the willingness to really engage in the battle. And among the many, many ways in which the chakras are explained, we go back to the Bhagavad Gita and the epic that preceded it, which is the Mahabharata, in which there were five righteous brothers. And this is a true historical epic, but also those five brothers have become archetypal images which represent the five chakras. And Arjuna, who is the greatest warrior of them all, is the third chakra. Okay. Now the whole battle, and this is in the epic of the Mahabharata, of which the Bhagavad Gita is one chapter, is this battle between cousins. So it's sort of like, it's like different dimensions of one family, which is to say different dimensions of your own nature. Okay, and it's the positive and negative expressions of the chakras. The whole battle depends on what Arjuna does, because the direction of our willpower and our fire either keeps us committed and trapped in limitation or magnetizes this lower energy, transforms it, and lifts it up toward the higher chakra. So everything depends on Arjuna being willing to engage in the righteous war. And everything about success in our life depends on our willingness to engage in the righteous war. And the righteous war is not, I'll stand up for what I want against you no matter what. The righteous war is, why do I feel the need to do that? Why am I fighting against the person I love most in the world? Why do I constantly keep falling into that? That's the wrong battle. That's not the righteous war. The righteous war is the fight against my own inclination to react to life rather than to respond. Now, I'm not talking about being a doormat, because the right response may be, really, truthfully, you say, calmly and lovingly, you have to have the heart in it, and I'll go there in a moment. That's really not going to work for me. That's really not appropriate, and I will not stand for it. It's not that you have to accept everything, but the first war is to know what are my... Krishna, the Lord himself, who also represents the devotee's own intuition, is driving the chariot. And the chariot represents the body. Arjuna is the warrior, and he represents the personal power of each one of us and as the devotee's aspiration. They're about to go into battle, and Arjuna says to Krishna, wait a minute, I'm not sure I want to do this. And then he says to Krishna, take my chariot away from the field of conflict, let us think about this a little bit. And then Arjuna tries to justify the fact that he really doesn't want to engage in this fight. He says, the opponents are my cousins, because that's how the Mahabharata story is. In fact, it is two families raised together like brothers, but now they find themselves on opposite sides of the conflict. It depends on Arjuna to ruthlessly destroy these cousins in order to have possession of the kingdom, which rightfully belongs to them. The cousins are completely unrighteous in their demands, and it's not right to allow that negativity free sway. But still, Arjuna doesn't want to do it. These are my own people, he says. What joy would there be in my life if I just slayed them? And Krishna says to Arjuna in so many words, you're being very clever, but you're being very stupid. And mostly you're just lazy and cowardly. And Arjuna says, I am? No, that's what I'm being? Because it all made so much sense to him. And the symbolic behind it is that we think, well, you know, this is the way I've always been. This is the way my mother was. This is the way things are done. This is the way society does it. What will he think? What will they think? What will she think? You know, instead of saying, I have to root out of my nature these qualities, I have to find out what's really true, and I have to have the power to stand behind that and not hesitate. And Krishna also says, and it's about, the answer is about reincarnation, but it's also about self-transformation. Krishna says, you think that you slay these soldiers and they disappear, but they don't. The energy that was them, when you kill it, it rises up in a new form. It's free. And so what he's also saying there about us is, we think, who would I be if I'm not the dutiful wife? Who would I be if I'm not the responsible husband who always sacrifices himself and never thinks about himself? Who would I be if I didn't just let my wife have it the way she wants it? No, if you kill that which is not right for you, that energy will be freed and something new will come from it. But there has to be a tremendous amount of courage and willpower and willingness to face the fire and be an instrument of the fire before you can really begin to transform yourself into the higher levels where you really want to go. And it's here in the heart and in the throat chakra and, of course, in the spiritual eye that our real freedom begins to express. But unless Arjuna does battle with the rigidity and the fixedness and the false understandings of the lower chakras, you will never truly reach here. It will always be weak. And so a lot of times, when you counsel with people, you don't ever tell them anything. They tell you. And then you remind them of what they said. And so often you remind them and they say, yes, I know what I have to do, I'm just afraid to do it. Or I'm afraid of the sheer energy output that's going to be required. If I accept that this relationship is not going to have to work, I'm going to have to find another place to live, I'm going to have to find a job, I'm going to have to move to another, all the things that you're going to have to do. And that's all fire, that's all the willingness to generate that fire. Or you might have to give up the very pleasant thought that somebody else is to blame for your life. it's very, very nice to just be resentful. It's very relaxing to be resentful because you don't have to go to battle then with the true enemy. You can just sort of be like Don Quixote and joust with windmills, which is what they did to me, and never really get into the battle. So the willingness to say, I will fight the righteous fight, and I will understand what it is and I will do it, that's the third chakra. So if you lack that, then you need to do the affirmations for fire. I cast into the fire all the desires except the desire for truth. With courage and determination, I face whatever life gives me and embrace it with my will. You see, it's very powerful. If you can't say that, then work on your third chakra. However, all by itself, it can make you ruthless. And that's, again, I don't want to draw too fine a point on it, but to a certain extent, women have become a little bit ruthless, a little bit sort of so concerned about transforming our own reality that we don't always notice what we're burning up. And I see a lot of women burning up their own lives, burning up the people they care about in this determination to push that one value. Now, maybe that's right. Maybe that's right for that person. It just depends on what you're balancing. But in a relationship, you also have to have the expansive energy of the heart. You have to also be able to break, and the heart energy is air. Now, air gives the impression of unity. Because we look around through the air, and they're just like, there seems to be like everything is embraced by it. Form has been dissolved by fire. The fire burns up the wood, and it rises up as smoke and heat. Okay, now the thing about air is that unity is still a little bit illusory. A little bit of an illusion. And it's not, you're not really safe until you're at the fifth or the sixth chakra, where you're really united by spirit. But the heart is when you begin to feel other people's realities as your own. Form has been dissolved enough, so you may have this fire that wants to express and be these certain things, but if there's enough heart energy, you're also conscious of the implications or the effect of that. No, if you're always on people to be different, because that's what you need, and you have insufficient heart energy, you don't see what you're doing to them. So often women don't see the effect of their constant insistence. There was a period of time when I was learning this myself. Men and women are much more like each other than any of us are like any other species. Men and women are really very, very similar. But we are just a little tiny bit different. We're two sides of the same coin. We're separated by that very little thin edge. And women, for women, communication, a certain kind of consideration, a certain awareness of certain things, it's just so obvious. And if you're engaged with a man that you really like, the problem is he's probably almost perfect. If he just talked a little bit more, if he was just a little more willing to explore his feelings, if he was just a little more conscious of your birthday and the importance of flowers, you know, whatever it might be, so little that you're asking of him. And then you spend years of your life trying to get him to change that little much. It finally occurred to me that that little difference is the difference between men and women. And if you were born a woman, you were born to sort of be in that touchy-feely, always aware of the nuances. You know, women are the moon, and the moon waxes and wanes and waxes and wanes, and every day is different. Every day is a new experience and a new dimension, and you're always sort of dealing with these nuances of things. Men are the sun. They rise, they set. They rise, they set. You know, they get up, they go off, they do what they have to do, they come home and they set. And very slowly over the course of a year, you know, they'll shift around a little bit. Now, you can see, depending on what you're trying to learn, you chose to be a man, you chose to be a woman. A man may have chosen to be a man because he wants to just rise and set. You know, he's had it with all this, you know, waxing and waning and waxing and waning and always feeling all these tiny nuances. He just wants to put his mind on the goal and go to it. He may have been way overbalanced in the other way, or who knows what, or not ready to do it. This is where his strength comes. The woman says, wax and wane with me. And he says, I can't and I won't. And she says, be the moon. And he says, I am the sun. And what the heart energy does for you is it puts you in their reality. You break down your own reality and you stand and you think of it from their point of view. What is this person really trying to do? And even if you know that what you want for them is better than what they want for themselves, you probably don't respond real well to that. And neither does anyone else. A person can only go to what they understand. I had a year-long undercurrent argument with David one year where I just sort of set my will that I wanted him to be a certain way, and he set his will that not on your life, honey. And we weren't arguing, but it was just like always an undercurrent. And finally, I'm too sensitive. I really didn't like it. He didn't like it either, but he was not going to give in to me. And I said, I sort of had this little conversation with him where I said, do you know what it is that I'm trying to make you do? He said, oh, yes. I said, do you agree that it would be, you know, expansive for you to be that way? He said, yes. I said, then why don't you do it? He said, because it's not my priority right now. You know, I'm working on other things. That was a very honest answer because I hadn't looked at it from his point of view. I hadn't really seen what number was up for him. I mean, all of us can have a great long list of ways we'd like to change, but somehow certain things come up, and that's what you can do. No one else can set that for you, and nor should you allow them to, because it takes away certain fundamentals of your own. But if you don't want it, you can't insist on it. And that's what the heart allows you to do. The heart, because it's air, allows you to feel unified even if the forms are different. And the heart tempers that fire, and then you use that fire on your own self to discipline your own misunderstandings instead of using it on the person close to you. And if you don't have enough of that warmth of heart and just have that fire, relationships are very, very difficult. I have friends of mine who've been married for a long time. She has such a wonderful habit, which I don't have, and that habit is, ha, 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 ha. She just finds everything amusing. I take things so seriously, and her husband will do outrageous things, and she will laugh. And I'm just sort of learning to laugh, just learning to be amused instead of so put out. You know, just what difference does it make? I have a principle now that I follow, which is I ask myself if, and I mean, this is all, you know, David and I have always had a good relationship. I exaggerate some of the difficulties in order to just make the point, so I don't want to be unfair to him or to me. But it's gotten a lot better as I have figured a lot of this stuff out. And he's responding to me a lot better as I have figured a lot of this stuff out. I ask myself, I'm upset because he's not X, Y, and Z. And this goes back to what are your core values? And I say, if he never changes and is like this for the rest of his life, is it still more fun to live with him than it would be to live without him? And even though that may sound like an extreme statement over something like the fact that David is a wonderful housekeeper but never rinses the dishes, he'll just pile them in the sink, What a weird thing to do. I can't understand why he doesn't understand to just rinse the dishes, but he doesn't. He won't rinse the dishes. Okay? I say, so for the next 20 years of our lives together, there will always be egg stuck on the dish and I'll have to scrub it off. Do I want to leave him over it? And if the answer is no, then forget it. Because what difference does it make? Is it a marriage buster, is the question. And if you really start thinking, is this going to take down the relationship? Is it worth using my fire to try to change this? Or should I use my fire to go higher and to draw my energy up into my heart and feel that sense of unity that we have together? Do you see? Swami Kriyananda's parents, Ray and Gertrude Walters, were an exceptional individuals and had an exceptional marriage. They were married for 60 years. Swamiji said even among their friends, and marriages lasted more steadily during that generation. She died 20 years ago in her 80s. They died in their 80s 20 years ago, so it gives you an idea of where they, what, when they lived. But even among their friends, they were exceptional because they never even argued. They were just extremely harmonious together. And it was a genuine harmony. It wasn't a harmony of oppression or a suppression of any kind. It was just they got along. People would ask Ray, and he had a very good sense of humor, you know, what is the secret of your happy marriage? And Ray said, well, he said, when we first got married, I said, Gertrude, I am the man, and I will make all the important decisions in this relationship. And, well, since we decided to get married, there just haven't been any other important decisions to make. And that really sort of sums it up. The will says, I have to have my way. The heart says, why? What difference does it make? And now, if he's genuinely trying to oppress you, or she's genuinely trying to take away from you something fundamental, you may have to stand up. But go first to the heart, into that. Now, you can see, however, if you have air, and you have lots of air, which a lot of people do, oh, I'm so kind, you know, I love you, and it's just nice, it's all right what you do, everything is, you know, it's your truth, it's just fine. But there's no personal power behind it. You just blow around. And you drift from here, you drift to there, and you never really make anything of your life. You're just sort of being batted like a balloon. Or if you have no core values, or you have no creativity, but your creativity is merely to drift, the heart can be very, very weak in that sense. Or if the heart expects too much, let me think how to say that. The problem also with the heart is it's right at this transition point. And so the energy of the heart, if it's allowed to flow without enough discipline, can fall back into too specific a form. I love so much, you can love so easily, you're passionately in love with this man or this woman, but then they die, or they don't love you back, or they betray you in some way, and they go away. And your love has been defined in a downward moving direction. It's been defined entirely according to form. And so then you lose it, and then you believe that you've lost your love. So the love of the heart has to also be directed upward and realize that it's not this form that I love, it's the expression of spirit that came through that form. But even behind that, it's the expression of spirit that I love. And the real expansive quality of the heart is when you move it upward, that you may love whomever deeply because God has sent them to you as your child or your mother or your spouse or whatever it might be. But what you really love is the power of God behind that. And above all, what you love is what God sends you. Now, do you hear the subtlety in that? I remember when I was very first married to David, I had a very important experience. I had been single for so long, and I liked being single, but I wanted to live with David more than I wanted to live alone. It wasn't a matter of lifestyle, it was very specific. But I was aware of just all these emotional things that, you know, had always come up for me with relationships, and I was stunned to see them all just coming out again. And I did one of those things that men usually don't do, but women are very good at, where you create an emotional crisis out of very little material. You know, you just have a feeling, and then he doesn't respond to that feeling, and then you're upset because he didn't respond, and then you remember that he never responds, and then you think about, will he ever respond? And nothing has really happened except all of your reactions to the original nothing. David once said to me, I'm going to digress. This is chilling when you hear it. It chilled me when he said it. He said, everything is fine and then you get upset. Now, what is my first fire response? How dare you say that? If I'm upset, it's not fine. Isn't that the natural response? But David doesn't waste words, and he always has something behind what he says. So I stood back and I thought it, and this is what I realized. You have to also see things. You have to have enough heart energy and creative energy to see into what that person actually is doing. We're all raised differently. We have a different sense of things. I mumble. I have a tendency to have a soft voice. And David is so frustrated because so often he can't hear what I say that he at times takes it personally. You know, he thinks I'm doing something to him. But I haven't, and if he gets really upset with me because I've mumbled, he's creating, I'm reversing it. Nothing has happened, and then he's upset. All I've done is just mumble because I mumble. I'm not trying to make his life miserable, but if he gets mad at me, then suddenly we'll have an argument about it. David's tendency is to be more abrupt in the way he speaks and less flowery. He uses a minimal amount of words, where I would use a big amount of words. If, for example, I have mumbled, instead of saying, excuse me, honey, I'm so interested in what you have to say. What was that again? You know, isn't that lovely? He'll say, what? And actually, everyone in his family talks like that. They're just sort of blunt, right? My family loved words. If you could use 7 instead of 2, then you would use 7. If you could use 15 instead of 5, use 15. It's just the way we were. His family, it's like you just communicate, what? Me, oh God, that what would just like, I would take it so to heart. How could you be so inconsiderate? My girlfriend, who laughs a lot, suffers because her husband doesn't open the car door for her, put on her jacket. Now, to me, that means nothing. But she was raised in a family where her father always just had that little attention. And to her, that just means so much that he doesn't do that. But nothing has really happened until she got upset. Do you see? Because he wasn't trying to hurt her or show her that he didn't care about her or be inconsiderate about her core values. He just never thought about it and probably never will. Because it's just not in him. David's never going to use 15 words instead of 7 because he doesn't believe in using 15 words instead of 7. He's just going to say, what? And all that happened was he couldn't hear what I said. But if I get upset, then a huge story begins. I mean, and even on a much more profound level, I was talking to someone recently about, you know, he was supposed to take her out to dinner. He got tied up somewhere else. He didn't call her until it was really late. She was waiting. By the time he got there, she was so mad at him. And then he got so upset because she got mad at him. But he could have called her. But he didn't not call her out of a deliberate desire to ruin her life. He just didn't call her because he's a bit of an airhead, that's all. You know? And he's just sort of fundamentally in many different ways an airhead. And so he's probably never going to think to call her. It's just not going to occur to him. Nothing has happened until you get upset. Do you see? Now, there are things that have happened, and you have to get upset. But I would say 99.99% of the things that we get upset about didn't actually happen until we made them happen. Right? Now, how can you possibly keep in touch with that? You have to have a lot of core value. You have to know where you stand and be loyal to that. You have to have a lot of creativity. You have to have a lot of fiery self-control. You have to have a lot of attunement with your heart and a desire to stay in that love and not go away from it. Once you decide to be together, what is more important? Right? As long as all this is in line, you can't be selling yourself out for the sake of this, but again, and everyone says relationships are so much hard work. They really aren't in that sense. It's not hard work like this, but it's very hard work inside. But that's not relationships, that's life. That's life. And a lot of times we have this thought that relationships will rescue us from life. They won't. Zero. Absolutely zero. Nothing will rescue from life. And that's part of being willing to engage in the battle. That's Arjuna. I will fight the good fight, and if it's in marriage, fine. back to the situation where I was, where I was creating, really creating out of nothing, really, like silently, all by myself, creating a crisis, where I genuinely wondered whether we had to get divorced. And David is just going about his life, you know, and I'm just sitting here creating a huge crisis, which finally bubbled out and, you know, smeared all over the living room for a period of time. And after it had sort of settled itself down, I thought to myself, you know, this is tough. Here I am, and I'm going to be here for a long time with this guy, and just look how vulnerable I am. So I had a thought, I'm going to use my willpower to harden my heart. Ah, that's a good idea. I'm going to withdraw a little bit from here because it's too tough. I mean, you know, I'm so vulnerable, I'm just going to get creamed. But I thought to myself, that doesn't seem like a very good direction to go, especially not like so early in the relationship. We've all seen those marriages, those 50-year marriages that they should have broken up at year two, where they're still together, but there's nothing happening. Because each time this thing happened, we went down. We hardened into some form instead of going past it. But I also said to myself, this is a good man, a great man. And I wouldn't, I mean, I love him, I want to be with him, I admire him enormously, but is he Jesus Christ? Probably not. You know, does he have karma of his own that he's going to have to work out? Probably. It's a fair bet that he's going to have to. Does that mean that just like me, he's going to screw up from time to time? Probably. Is he likely even to do something colossally wrong? It could happen. Because, how do I know that? Because I think the chances are pretty good that I will, right? And the chances are pretty good that if we were attracted to each other, we're about the same. You know, that's just sort of how you are. You've just got enough in common that you're there. So I said, well, this could be a very dangerous situation. I mean, how can I trust him? That's the question everybody says. How can I trust him? And I thought, well, probably you can't. Now, that sounds very cynical and really has nothing to do with David. Because as people go, he's ultimately trustworthy. He's a marvelous person. But life is untrustworthy. How can he swear to me that he has no catastrophic karma that he's ever going to have to face? You know, drive into a tree on his bicycle and become a completely different person. Meet another woman with whom he has a very powerful connection. Not that he would go that way easily, or that has ever even threatened our marriage. But you always have to say, I came out of nowhere. Somebody else can come out of nowhere. Maybe I get really mixed up and get off base and leave him sort of wandering around out there and make him vulnerable to something. None of these things have come even close. But nonetheless, I can't make my security on the promise that he is going to be a certain way. So I asked myself, what do I love? What do I trust? Well, I love him. I love the energy that comes through him. But I love the fact that God has asked me to do this. And my trust is really that God is in charge of my life. Right? And God has brought me to this position of being in this marriage and working on this relationship. And whatever God brings me in or outside of that, that's what I trust. And that also comes back to trusting yourself enough to have the energy and the courage to respond to that. Where does that come from? It comes from these chakras, right? I know what's important. I have the creativity. I have the fire. And I love truth. And truth is this relationship that's been given to me to do. But it's the truth that I love, not the relationship. Do you understand? And when you're there, you're always safe. Is it always easy? Are you always happy on a day-to-day basis? No, not necessarily. But you're always safe because you put your trust in the only thing that's trustworthy. And then everybody around you is going to do their best. Please don't get involved closely with somebody who deliberately will not do their best or is out to hurt you. Use your willpower and your common sense and get away from that. But once you're in something that's right, then you put your trust beyond it. You look right into the eyes of the person you care about, and you look right through them. And then you can be absolutely personal. You can be just as how adorable you are, how much I love you, but you're not really loving that limited form. You're loving what flows through. Do you see the difference? Okay, and then the heart expands beyond the specific form, because loving that power has no form. It's whatever form you're in. Then you move from the heart to the throat chakra. Okay. And the throat chakra, they call it ether. Ether is a word that is is an arcane word that comes more from the Eastern tradition, because ether is more subtle than air. Ether is the unifying energy behind even the air. You know, all the different elements of air, everything, is they called it ether. They used to call it that way philosophically in the West, too. And what that means is that even the illusion of the separate gases is dissolved by the unity behind it. And this is also the chakra, they speak of it as the self-expansion. It's also the chakra of communication. And true communication isn't just telling my truth, which is what comes from the third chakra. True communication is really relating on a level of reality that's reciprocal. So you can speak your own truth from the third chakra, but you have to, if you've really learned to love, and you start speaking it from the fifth chakra, you're really speaking a truth that is expansive and beneficial. And sometimes that truth is spoken in silence, as what's the point? You know, it's just, how well do you respond to being constantly criticized? I know, it's like we have this thought, and so it's a modern thought that the way to get people to change is to always tell them what's wrong with them. And you just think about it, but people don't change when they're constantly being criticized. You get so nervous when you're constantly criticized. People change when they feel secure enough to risk it. Right? That's what causes you to change, when you feel loved and secure enough to risk going in a new direction. If you always feel threatened, we always harden down. And so we definitely want to communicate. It's very important to share your reality, but if you don't share it in such a way that it creates a greater sense of unity, then all of this just drives people apart. And it's one of the plagues of our ages to think like that. All right, where are we? We are almost at the end, so if there's anything lingering, you need to speak up now or forever hold your peace. So any comments or questions, places that we need to go that we haven't gone yet? Okay. This isn't your last actual literal moment, but I just wanted to. Okay. Let me just talk a little bit more about the last two chakras. Pardon me? Yes, I did. Thank you, Marilyn. The sixth chakra is the spiritual eye, and the sixth chakra is really, in many ways, the only one you really need to know about. It's the center of Christ consciousness. It's the point at which the separating energy that takes us out into this false sense of self, the small s self, finally gets itself organized enough to become aware that, in fact, I am the infinite self. And the perfect image is waves on the ocean. We are waves on the ocean. The waves exist. There's no question about it. Look at the waves going up and down, having all these adventures, going into the beach, coming back from the beach, intersecting with other waves, getting big, getting small, getting rained on, being calm. All of these things happen, but a wave has no separate reality. The wave is just the result of the whole ocean. And all the other waves have no separate reality. They're all just expressions of the same ocean. When you live on the tip of the wave, that's not obvious. And what the process of self-realization is to become aware of really what's happening here. So you remain a wave, but being a wave knowing that you are a wave on the ocean is very different than being a wave and thinking that everything begins and ends with the wave. You can also see that if you're trying to run your life from just being a wave, it's a little confusing because you just get it all worked out. Okay, I'm heading for the beach. This time when I go to the beach, I'm going to stay there. And the wave goes to the beach and it grabs a hold on the sand and it thinks, finally, I made it onto the beach, right? And then somehow or another, you feel yourself just getting sucked back and you don't even know why if you're only thinking in terms of the wave. I mean, you know, getting up onto the beach can be a whole incarnation of finally trying to get it all together and, look, I made it. I had the right family, I got the right job, I got good kids, nobody messed up, I got to keep the house, everything worked fine, I made it. And whoop, there comes death, and you get sucked off the beach again. And you can't figure out why it's all slipped between your fingers. Well, the process of pulling all that together coming into an awareness at the sixth chakra, at the spiritual life, focusing your energy here, the vibration here, is to say, yes, the wave is having this incredible because of the ocean. And so go ahead, be the wave, but be the wave in relation to the ocean and recognize that I need to be in tune with the ocean because that's what's making the wave happen. And then everything that happens to the wave makes sense, is predictable, and is much more enjoyable because even if the wave crashes on the beach, what difference does it make? Because it's really just an extension of the ocean, and if I live in the whole ocean, let the wave do what it will. And this is the great secret of having freedom and courage and self-sufficiency and the ability to get along with other people because you know, it's not merely, I mean, even if your waves crash together, we just go back to the place where we're all one ocean. And we recognize they were all just playing out this incredibly complex dance. That's what this chakra gives us. And so the point is to get all of this energy focused from this point of view. And in a very practical sense, you begin to relate to all of life this way. Yes, that wave is bouncing like this and my wave is in relation to it. But if I live from here, then I even understand, how should I use my fire? What should I love and how should I love it? How should I express and expand? Because I see it, I have to relate to the wave coming at me, but understanding that we're both from the same ocean makes me relate to it very differently. And also, what would the ocean do? I mean, the images aren't perfect, but what is the ocean trying to make happen here? Not merely how do I feel about that wave, but what is the ocean doing with this wave? And how does that wave relate to all the other waves? And then we know what our response should be. So all of our energy, when the chakras flow properly, energy circulates through all of these chakras and all of these vibrations are then expressed in harmony with the whole. And so even if it's my wave's turn to stand up and shine, I do it in harmony with the whole. And if it's my wave's turn to be a little trough, I'm a little trough. And I just am a little trough and there's all these other big waves around me, but it's not so bad because I'm doing it in an understanding of the whole. Now, there's also, Yogananda added some understanding here, which is very important, which is that when we live with our consciousness from here, an understanding from the spiritual eye, we live in harmony with the spirit. The polar opposite of that is the medulla. And I spoke earlier of the sperm and ovum coming together at the medulla. This is our habitual point of view, and our habitual point of view is egocentric, which is starting with the separateness of ourself and looking out at the world from there. People who are very egoic are often talked about being proud and looking down at the world like this. It's not because of the nose, looking down their noses, because tension develops here. And you'll notice sometimes if you're scared or nervous a little bit, you'll sort of end up pulling your head back. And sometimes you'll see, especially a lot of popular performers, a lot of singers, they're always going like this. You know, they're throwing their head around, you watch them sing. And if you really look at it, it's because all their energy is back here in the ego. And they're just moving all the time from the ego. And whereas universal gesture of humility is to release that energy and bow, isn't it? To lower your head, because then you pull that energy down instead of always pulling it up like this. A lot of us get headaches from the medulla because you're just always, you know, that egoic tension trying to hold everything together. So we really just literally take the sense of self with the small s from here to here. And without teaching you any of it, because there's no time at all, the whole practice of meditation, as Yogananda taught it, is to concentrate at the spiritual eye, far better than the navel or other things, because then if you generate magnetism here, it draws all the other energy into it. Your sense of security becomes related to your relationship to the ocean. Your sense of how to use your personal power relates to how becoming part of the ocean. Your relationship to other people, your love energy, relates to being part of the ocean. And even people who aren't nice, who you don't like at all, you can still love them because there are waves on the ocean. You feel compassion, you feel unity with them from the fifth chakra because, yes, they're very unpleasant and doing terrible things, but still, they're just all part of the same ocean. And so all of the other qualities come to here. Now, you can't always go directly to the spiritual life, but the more you live there, the more everything in your life goes beautifully. Especially your relationships, because this is the source of all that you're trying to squeeze out of someone else. And so often, especially these days, your relationships are perfectly fine. It's just they are what they are. I have to repeat one of my mantras that I always say in relationships classes, which I haven't yet said, so here it comes. Think about where we learned about relationships in this culture. We learn from popular music, you know, these very romantic songs, some enchanted evening, you know, I look across and there he is, and you're mine and I will always be yours, and like that. And we learn it from the music, and it sets this whole mood that just takes us into this something. And then we learn it from novels, you know, from these torrid Harlequin romances in which he and she, and then they finally get together, and then it's just, they kiss, and then all of the universe changes, and everything is, and just these incredible, I sometimes read those books because they're very entertaining, but there's always the moment when they kiss, and when they kiss, everything happens from that point. I mean, kissing is very nice, and it's very nice, one that you really like, but God, I mean, how much can happen with a kiss? It's just two bodies smishing together. There's just, it's really only so much can happen. And so you read these books, but you're persuaded that all this is going to happen. And so you have these novels. Then you have movies, which are so vivid. Just such vivid stories in the, where you have everything together. You have the fictionalized story, you have the vision, and you have the music. And that, for the most part, of course they had television, for the most part, that's where people get their information about relationships. Well, I forgot to mention advertising. You know, just these commercials and these pictures and these two-second flashes of people having wonderful lives. You know, 2 seconds of a wonderful life. And but on a very deep level in our culture now, we are all walking around as if those images were the real images. And what they all have in common is that they're fiction. They're fiction. They're not real stories. And they're not art, even. Art is fiction. True art is fiction, but it has captured the essence of truth. Now, Shakespeare's plays, Romeo and Juliet, is fiction, but still there's something so profoundly true in that story, the true story as Shakespeare wrote it. When you read it, you are so uplifted. Not always when you see it performed, because it depends on who does it, but when you read it, you are so uplifted because you've got into the heart of something where love is, people will sacrifice everything for love. That's a truth, for true love. That's a truth. That's different, okay? But all this fiction is so confusing to people, because now that our culture has also broken down and nobody lives anywhere near anybody, and you don't have any uncles or aunts or grandfathers or cousins, very rarely, and even if you do, they've probably been divorced 4 times like you, you know, so it's just sort of hanging around out there. And so people go to the movies and then they go home and it doesn't match. They listen to the radio and they go home and it doesn't match. They read a Harlequin romance and they go home and it doesn't match. Then they come to people like me and they say, I think this isn't going to work out. And I say, why? And I know Swamiji once said to one woman, he said, but all marriages are boring. That's the great secret no one tells anyone. Meaning, sometimes marriages are boring. In other words, if you're bored, your marriage is boring, if you don't have enough of this creative energy. Or I've heard him say, it sounds like you're a very good friend, seems like a perfect match to me. Oh, but there's no passion, there's no this, there's no that. Well, where did you get the idea that that on an everyday basis was what you were supposed to experience? Well, because I saw the movie, because I heard the music, because I read the book. And so a lot of what it is that we have a misunderstanding of life. We think that life is going to give us this sort of thing, and we especially think that relationships will. Now, don't misunderstand me. I have a wonderful marriage. It's very happy. Yes, it's boring sometimes. Sometimes he bores me, and sometimes I bore him. We love to be apart from each other. I'll come home from short trips, and I'll say, did you miss me? He's too honest to say he did. Did you miss me even a little? You know? I mean, and he does, and we really prefer to be together than to be apart, but we love being apart. Because our joy comes from within. And because our joy comes within from within, we really love being together. I love being married to him. But it's not like a movie. It's not anything like a movie. In fact, you know what? It's 100 million times better because it's real. This is what really happens in life. And the creativity is from us. It's not given to us automatically. And so in our culture too, what's happening is people are expressing dissatisfaction and fighting, and you're not giving me something, this isn't working for me, when what's being asked is impossible. It's a fictional request. I want you to sort of do all this stuff and have me feel all this way all the time. We're totally overstimulated. We just don't know what's real. Love is absolutely wonderful, but it has to start from the sense that love is the reality. And then I have love, I share love, I am love, and we can enjoy it together. If it's because you love me and I love you, and you love me and I love you, and you love me and I love you, because you love me, I must be really special, and you must be really special because I love you, you're just locking yourself down here. And God will just say, I think I'll break that one up. Your own soul will say, you know, even though you pretend to be having a good time, your soul will say, we really can't go on with this forever. Something's got to happen. And if nothing else happens, you just get wiped out and die. And you just get to start over again. But why bother? Why not learn it now? Right? That's really what this is about. Work on your reality. Someone said to me once, why don't you all talk more about marriage as like a spiritual path, and, you know, the spiritual path of marriage and how marriage relates to the spiritual path? And I went home and I thought about that, and I came back and I said, because there is nothing to say. All there is to talk about is the spiritual path. All there is to talk about is your own inner reality. Work on it. Then you can do anything. And if your external life is blowing up in your face all the time, there's a clue that maybe there's something going on inside. And as I've been through this, look at this. How is it blowing up? What are you consistently doing? And instead of trying to force the world around you, maybe you need to make changes. Maybe you wake up from this and say, this is not a compatible situation. But you say, let me get in balance. Two things will happen. One is you will be able to function in balance. And if you're well matched, you will be able to carry that out successfully. And you'll be able to enjoy what it has to give you and not be unrealistic about it. Or if you're not well matched, you will begin to vibrate the way you need to vibrate in order to find a match, to attract somebody who will be, you'll be able to work with. And she was unmarried and was hopelessly in love with someone who didn't love her at that time. And so she was miserable because of that. I said, you know, it's just a quota of misery. We each have our own. I'm married because, my marriage is disintegrating. You're married because you're miserable because you don't have one. I'm miserable because I am married and you're miserable because you're not. That was the situation we were facing. We're miserable. You don't have to put a line on the end of it. Just work on putting yourself in balance, and then also what happens is you'll know what to do. It'll be obvious to you what to do. Sometimes people come to me and they think they need to leave their relationships, but it's not time to leave your relationship because your relationship is not really what's making you miserable. You're making yourself miserable. Get yourself a little bit more in order, and then maybe you will need to leave. But you'll be leaving because because it's truly timely to have the form change, not merely out of the illusion that if I change the form, my life will be different. And that goes the other way. If I'm miserable, I'm going to get all these things together, I'm going to start being loving, I'm going to start doing this as soon as there's somebody to focus it on. Ooh, what a myth that is. Because you just won't, you're going to be who you are, period. So if you want to be that kind of person, be it. I always had a desire to have children, because I thought that mothers were great people. And so I thought if I became a mother, I would be a great person. And I had this image of, you know, how generous and loving and kind mothers are. And I saw myself, and I probably would have been a pretty good mother. I saw myself being generous and loving and kind and so on. And it was all associated with after I had a baby, after I had five babies, then I would be this great mother. And then just one awful day, I realized that I could have 60 children. And I would still be exactly who I was. And that it was a very deep delusion in my mind that the mere procreation would make me into a better person. And in a very interesting way, I just lost the desire. It had been the only defining reality of my life until that time was the deep desire to have a baby. And then as soon as I saw what I was doing with that, it just went away and has virtually never come back. And I never have had a child. It's been fine for me. because it really wasn't what I wanted. And so I just went right to the main thing. Other people, you know, it's perfect. I am married, so not everyone marries either. It just depends on what's there. But don't lose track of who you're really trying to be. Well, that is my story for today. Is there more that anybody wants to ask about? Or? Going, going, gone. Okay. Oh, the crown chakra. Thank you. The crown chakra, everybody always asks about. It's the seventh chakra at the top of the head. And some people teach you that you should concentrate on the crown chakra, that you need to meditate on the crown chakra and so on. Yogananda does not teach that. And I accept that teaching is true, and here's the reasoning. Our consciousness is really at the medulla. And we need to move the consciousness from the medulla to the spiritual eye. Once we have moved it to the spiritual eye, the channel between the spiritual eye and the Sahasrara, the seventh chakra, opens automatically. It cannot be opened from the medulla directly. And that is actually the esoteric meaning of Jesus' saying, no one comes unto the Father except through me. Me is the Christ consciousness. The Father is spirit beyond creation. No one comes to the Father, to the spirit beyond creation, except by first realizing Christ consciousness. So to meditate here or try to open this is not the way the circuitry works. It's like trying to breathe out of the knee. You have to work with the lungs if the problem is breathing. If the problem is the ego that needs to be liberated from its narrow focus to understand the divine, focus at the Christ center. And once that's done, you don't have to worry. This happens automatically. So it's there, but in all of the teaching that Yogananda and Kriyananda offer, they always suggest the route that I'm describing. These five chakras relate primarily to your functioning in the world. The spiritual eye is the focal point that brings all of the five chakras into balance, and then the Sahasrara will take care of itself once you're there. Thank you. Okay?